we're talking with Dr. William Weil, who is the founding chair of the Department of Pediatrics and Human Development at Michigan State University. Bill, tell us to begin with a little bit about your background.
Well, I was a World War II medical student, so went to medical school during the war, which was at an accelerated pace so they could turn out doctors rapidly. We did all 8 years of pre-med and medicine in 5 calendar years. So I graduated as a very young guy. And just as I finished my medical training, the war ended. So I went out and did an internship in Minneapolis, which is where I'd gone to medical school.
Okay.
And then went on to Philadelphia for residency training in pediatrics. And it was there the residency director was Andy Hunt, who had just come back from service in the military and was the director of residency training at Children's Hospital. Well, that's
and,
where we...
He okay, and Andy was the founding dean of our medical school.
That's right, and that's where we first met. And we had just gotten married. Back in those days, you couldn't marry as a medical student or an intern. So as soon as we finished our internship, we got married, my wife and I. Then we moved to Philadelphia and met the Hunts.
Mm-hmm.
So I did 2 years of training in Philadelphia and then went on to spend a year at Children's Hospital in Boston in a post-internship residency. And while there, it was about that period when the doctor's draft was still active, and we were going to go off and serve in the military. And about a week before I left Philadelphia, I got a letter saying, our class is full down at San Antonio, so you'll wait for a while before we call you. Well, at that point, I had applied previously to go to Boston and had told him I was going to be drafted, and so I didn't go. But then at the last minute, I did, and I ended up going to Boston Children's for a year. Then the man I worked with there went to Cleveland, to Western Reserve, so I went with him to Cleveland, and we spent a couple of years there before we went into the military.
Were you still a student in Cleveland, or were you?
No, I was a faculty member by that time. I had done my residency. I'd done a year of fellowship, which was considered at that time a lot. You know, not excessive, but not a small amount of time. So I was a junior faculty member in Cleveland and stayed there for a couple of years. And then the military finally found me, and we went off to serve for 2 years in the military. We were transferred, we were sent to the Chemical Warfare Center in Maryland, which is just outside Baltimore. And as a result, we were doing research on antidotes to nerve gas. But we had Saturdays off because there was nothing to do on Saturday except train for the military. Well, we were all medical people, so we wrote little excuses for each other so we didn't have to take part in training.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned that I could go down to Baltimore to Johns Hopkins and work with the pediatric endocrine group who worked all day Saturdays in their clinic. So they had a 1-day-a-week clinic, which was all day Saturday. They took the entire outpatient department, so they would bring in 20, 30 patients at one time.
Right.
and there were enough fellows and residents and so on to each work up a patient in a separate room. And then the head of pediatric endocrinology would go from room to room. Anyway, that's, I spent most of the 2 years on Saturdays at Johns Hopkins.
And during the week you were basically
I was working, doing chemical warfare research. And it was fun because we had, as lab assistants, we had all the PhDs in chemistry and biology who'd been drafted. And they were serving as lab assistants. So we got a lot done, and we worked out an antidote for nerve gas poisoning, which subsequently got published in the open literature by the Swiss. But anyway, it was successful. And then I left, went back to Case Western Reserve. I stayed there for a little while, actually till 1963, and then was offered a position in the University of Florida, which at Gainesville had a new medical school, relatively new, and went there. And now, at that point, Andy Hunt had gone to Huntington Medical Center in New Jersey and worked for a while. Then he'd gone to Stanford Medical School and was running the outpatient department for pediatrics at Stanford. Then he got called by John Hanna to Michigan State. And he came to Michigan State 1964. Must have been 63 or 64. Anyway, after he got here, he wrote me or called me and said, would I come with him to Michigan State? Well, I'd only been in Florida for just about a year, not quite, and all sorts of things were going on. So I said, no, this was not an opportune time. So I didn't hear again from him for a while. Then I got another message from him a couple of years later. Turned out, in the meantime, he tried to recruit some people that hadn't worked out, and so he wanted to know whether I'd be interested. Now the medical school was about to bring its first class on board, and was I interested? So after some desultory correspondence, with a fair amount of misunderstanding at times, we got all that sorted out. And it turned out that at that point, the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor was looking for a chairman of pediatrics as well. So I was being recruited in Ann Arbor and East Lansing at the same time, which was kind of interesting because I'd go there and come here and come here and go there. After about three visits, everybody was quite open, and we talked about this, the two deans, Dr. Hunt here and the dean at Ann Arbor, and myself. And there was great excitement in Ann Arbor because they were building a brand-new children's hospital. And it was already partially constructed. On the other hand, it's a very traditional medical school, and I felt this was not quite what I wanted. So I decided with the opportunity to start a totally new department here, I'd come to Michigan State and arrived here in 1968.
What were you leaving in Florida?
What was I leaving?
Yeah.
I was leaving an endowed professorship, the A.I. DuPont professorship. I was then acting chair of the department there, although not permanent chair, when I left. We had a lot of interesting stuff going on. It was a lovely community, Gainesville. The problem was basically it was Southern. It was prejudiced. We had, my wife had actually been involved in trying to get the first black councilman elected to the city government, we had to have police protecting our home from being trashed by people. When we went to hold a political rally in our home, our children were picking up very obnoxious ideas in the school that they attended, and we felt that we couldn't really stay there much longer. Yeah. Anyway, it was incompatible with our own value system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we were leaving.
Okay.
A good job, well endowed, paying well, considering the time, and yet a community and a sociology that was incompatible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you came here in 1968.
Yes, right.
How did you see the job you were walking into?
Well, had no experience at all. But I knew what I wanted, and I wanted to start something different. The traditional pediatric departments around the country looked all alike. There were a bunch of subspecialty pediatricians who were specializing this, that, or the other thing. There was a research group. There were some practicing physicians. And it was pretty much the pattern all across the country. Mm-hmm. This had little appeal to me, or thankfully to Dr. Hunt, who was well experienced and trained and interested in behavioral pediatrics, mm-hmm. as well as medical clinical pediatrics. So that coincided with what I had in mind. We were a two-year medical school here at Michigan State when I came, and which really we were running for 3 years, but it was a two-year it was technically a two-year program. And there was already a department of medicine.
Okay.
And the idea was, in Dr. Hunt's mind, that the Department of Medicine would encompass all of the clinical elements of medicine, which included pediatrics and psychiatry and so on. Well, the chairman of psychiatry and myself, neither one were terribly comfortable with that. We each thought we would like our own little shop.
Right.
And Dr. Swisher, who was head of medicine, was a good guy, but he wasn't inclined to necessarily take over psychiatry and pediatrics. Mm-hmm. So there was no real objection to it, and psychiatry became a department.
Right.
And we became a department, but not wanting to have two clinical departments in a two-year or preclinical medical mm-hmm. school, we chose to be called a Department of Human Development rather than a Department of Pediatrics. Right. Now, nobody knew what a Department of Human Development was, and that was fine, because we really didn't want anybody to know. So we could be whatever we wanted to be. And we thought of this as a department that would be clinical to some extent, behavioral, and biological or research-oriented. So we looked to recruit basic science people, behavioral science people, and some pediatricians.
Okay.
And at that time, it was a good time to do things because there was money available, there were people available, there were no rigid rules or restraints that we were bound by. So it was an opportune time to try something very different. And that's what we tried to do.
So you were going to be teaching the first 2 years. What kinds of courses did you envision this new department doing?
Well, one of the sort of basic concepts of the new medical school that had been proposed was to have human development as an underlying theme to carry through the curriculum. So the students would begin by looking at early development, reproduction, fetal growth, infancy, adolescence, adulthood, and senescence in some kind of sequential order. And the basic sciences were going to be built around that same sequence. Well, it was a great idea, but never came to fruition. The few things that did, one was a beginning course in human development. And that's where we put some of our educational efforts. Then we got involved with teaching about doctor-patient relationship, which was one of the things that the educational group who were here wanted to focus on as part of the same behavioral group was the idea of how doctors related to patients.
Right.
And that became, from almost the beginning, one of the underlying pervasive themes of the college, of the medical school. Well, we liked that. That was right up our alley. And by this time, we had people interested in sociology, anthropology, psychology, as well as people in pediatrics who came because we were an educational institution. Recruiting in the first few years was basically to a school that valued teaching. And that meant we attracted people who loved to teach.
Right.
And that was a big focus, and the people who came were very much oriented that way. And that's that led to a lot of the success we had in the first few years. Because we recruited enough people so that although the medical faculty was very small, we were at least a significant part of it. And with everybody in the department liking to teach and wanting to teach, they got into all kinds of places. They ran small groups, they ran major interactions, they took administrative roles in the educational program, and they kind of invaded the system.
Around the school.
Yeah, right.
There were some people already on campus when you came here and joined the department.
And that was the part of the beginning of our department. It was much easier to take people from on campus and give them an appointment in the department than to go out and recruit new people. And they were interesting people. Dr. Hunt had gotten to know some of them before I came and introduced me to them. And it were people. There were people like Jim Trosko, who was in University College, which was at that time a early general education program in the university. And Jim was teaching physics, biochemistry. I'm not quite sure what he was teaching at that point, but he was anxious to do research and had no opportunity to do that in University College. So he was anxious to come on board, and although he wasn't really a typical medical school faculty member, he quickly fitted into the mold and became, again, one of the educators. And then there was Jim Higgins, who was in natural sciences and genetics, and he seemed to fit into our concept of human development. And there were people like Dorothy Arata, who was in sociology?
We think so. We're not sure.
Okay, well, we'll have to find out. Anyway.
She was an associate provost most of the time that I knew her.
Yeah, well, I don't think she was there yet when we recruited her, but she was involved. There was... I'm blocking the name of the embryologist in natural sciences.
Who's Jim Thomas.
Jim Thomas.
Yes.
Right. Jim, who eventually went on to become a physician and a psychiatrist.
Right.
But he was an embryologist when we were there, and he came on board because certainly embryology was part of human development. So we acquired people like that, and then we acquired a couple of other people. Art Corman came almost when I did. Now, I'd known Art way back when I was on the faculty at Case Western Reserve, and he was a medical student. And one of the things the faculty did back then was take care of medical students' kids. So they got them in rotation. So when Art's wife had a baby, I was next up, and I got their assignment and became the physician for their firstborn child. Mm. And we got to know each other quite well. And so when he was at Stanford, after I came here, or when I was planning to come here, I was good friends with the chairman at Stanford and with Art. So Art had finished his fellowship there, or was finishing it, needed a job, and he seemed like a good endocrinology type person. So he came essentially the same time I did.
Okay.
And he was kind of the first out-of-town recruit we had. Then I brought a young woman who was a nutrition postdoctoral individual. She worked with a friend of mine in New York and was looking for a postdoctoral position. And I brought with me from Florida several hundred rats that I was doing some nutritional experiments with. And I had them here, but I was being very busy with a lot of things. So I was hoping to find somebody to work with them. And Doris came along, and we recruited Doris. So Doris came as a nutritionist to the department.
Right.
And nutrition fitted in with our concept of early development, so she got involved with teaching as well. So everybody found a place in this educational endeavor.
Okay. Now, as I understand it, when the medical school was founded, the decision was made it wouldn't have its own so-called basic science departments, but would share the existing departments on campus. How does having an embryologist or somebody like Jim Trosko in your department relate to the kind of teaching that the disciplinary departments did?
Well, I think it fit pretty well. When we came to the school, there was nowhere near the amount of disciplinary boundary which exists now and existed then in many other places. But John Hanna had already founded places like veterinary medicine and agriculture, and where certain departments were part of different colleges. So biochemistry was part of vet medicine, biochemistry was part of ag science, and so on. So biochemistry became part of human medicine. And as a result, because of this intercollegiality, when we needed research space, biochemistry had some new space in in their new building, so they offered us laboratory space. And the other people often bridged the departments and often had appointments both in one college, like our department in human medicine and biochemistry. So joint appointments were quite common. And for several years, it worked very well. And we became quite integrated into the total university mm-hmm. system. And that's a value which those of us who were here very early held on to for a long time, although the mechanics of it got more and more difficult. The concept of it and the value of being part of a total university system was felt to be worth whatever effort it took to maintain it. So that's...
So why did it break down?
Well, it broke down for a lot of reasons, probably. But one that first comes to mind is money. We had more money than some of the other parts of the university. And also medical school faculty generally across the country were paid higher salaries than were other university faculty. And we needed to keep to some extent within that framework or we'd have trouble recruiting. So our salaries were a bit higher than they were in natural sciences or somewhere else. So when it came time to look at annual reappointments or promotions, or salaries, which were figured out each year, if we had 50% of an appointment and NatSci had 50%, we ended up paying 60 or 70% of the dollars because we needed that to get the salary up to a level that we could justify in the medical school. Well, this caused considerable dislocation. In addition, our criteria for promotion were somewhat different, and eventually it got to be such an administrative hassle that the joint appointments, which almost everyone had at the beginning, were almost all gone after about 3 or 4 years, 5 years maybe.
Okay. So in 1970, the medical school went from being 2 years to 4 years.
Right.
How did that impact what you wanted to do with the department?
Well, it changed things. Because now we had the prospect of having to teach clinical pediatrics, that is, the actual medical care of children, which up until then, as a two-year school, we taught about how kids learned and how they behaved and how they got, what their genetics was like and how to feed them. But suddenly, when we became a four-year medical school, we had to be able to talk about what to do for their pneumonia or their diarrhea or their meningitis. So we needed to have people who knew about those special clinical elements of care of children. And that changed our recruiting. At that point, we ended up recruiting more physicians and not so many people that weren't physicians. And that changed the posture of the department considerably. We continued to be very active in the teaching program, but we were beginning to get weighted much more into clinical medicine. And that process, unfortunately, continued at an increasing rate as time went on.
What about research activities in the early days? You had Doris Nairns running rats.
Yeah, and Art was doing research with biochemistry, and Jim Trosko was getting his molecular biology work going. Tom Helmrath, who came as a neonatologist, got working with the pig people on campus and was studying newborn pigs. for various issues in neonatology. Mike Bailey was working with, because he had a PhD in physiology as well as an MD, was working with the physiology department in issues having to do with renal function and hypertension. There was a fairly active research program going on. You have to remember also at that time, NIH money was easy to come by. It wasn't the struggle it is today. And I recall for myself, the very first NIH money award I received was in response to about a three-page letter, which I outlined something I wanted to do and got a check for $10,000 to do it, and that was a lot of money at that time. Actually, I used it to do a different project altogether, but nobody objected. That was all right, too. So it was a very different world in terms of research funding. A lot could be done with relatively small amounts of money.
And the department had some research seed money then, too, as I recall.
Well, that's right. We did have an initial award, a couple of initial awards, just general support dollars from outside the university that came to us as sort of general purpose money, which we could use as for research. And I recall one person who had been supported by grants who lost all his grant funding one year, and we were able to keep his lab going with just our general support dollars that we had within the department from outside sources. So, yes, we did have some. It wouldn't be considered much of anything today, but by then, at that time, it was a godsend.
We also had two or three lab techs.
Oh, yes.
And two or three graduate assistants.
Yeah, and these were
around.
And these were all paid on university funding.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this was a wonderful story because at one point, so we basically could provide everybody with a lab tech.
Yeah.
Or a graduate assistant, or two. And at one point, we needed a couple of new positions. And there were going to be X number for the medical school. Mm-hmm. Well, we learned that the Department of Medicine hadn't used those that had been awarded to them, so we went over and negotiated for them to give us a couple of their positions, which they did very happily.
Mm-hmm.
And that grew our research portfolio just a little larger. But there was a kind of sharing and willingness to support each other, which was ordinarily unheard of. And I attribute a lot of that to Dr. Swisher.
Mm-hmm. We also had a friend in the dean's office named George Walsh.
The finance manager for the department,
yes.
The comptroller.
College.
For the college, yeah. Was a wonderful guy, is a wonderful guy, he still is, who's written a novel, is doing a second novel. But he was an old school comptroller who allowed issues of right and wrong, his concept of right and wrong, to help determine how some of the discretionary funding got distributed. And because we were pretty straightforward, and if we had money left at the end of the year, we sent it back to him, in contrast with several other places. When there came to be some extra funding in the college, we often had an early opportunity to apply for or get that funding. So it was kind of a, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. As a result, we had a number of favorable financial situations that worked to our advantage.
So one of, at least one of which was mildly discriminatory, We hired Betty Siegel, and we only had half a position.
Yes, that's right. Right. I'm not quite sure how that... I can't remember the details of that, but Betty was is a psychologist and came originally just out of her graduate degree. I think she'd been working in the department even before she got her PhD.
Yeah.
She got her PhD, and we were able to raise the funding for the half position to make it equivalent to what she would have been getting as a full-time person. And as I recall, it could be...
We had half a salary for a physician.
Yeah.
And George said, well, psychologists are cheap. We'll hire her full-time for
that. That's what I meant, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So...
It took years to get her salary equitable.
Well, we had many irregularities at that point that because George was... Really pleased with how we did things.
Yeah.
We were able to get things done somewhat more easily than many others.
Okay. At this time, you were also active in quite a number of national endeavors.
Right. Well, it was sort of I was reaching, as I came here in the national scene, in academic pediatrics, I was kind of reaching a fairly high point in my own career. I got involved very early with the Society for Pediatric Research, which was there are two academic pediatric societies, the Society for Pediatric Research, which was at that time for people under 45, and then the American Pediatric Society, which was for the people over 45. Early on, through connections, because of my interest in kidney disease and related fluid electrolyte metabolism, I got to know... The secretary for the Pediatric Research Society, who was moving up into the adult society. So he said, why don't you take over as secretary for the younger society? Well, this was not such a big deal, but it was valuable to me to get to know people around the country even better. And it was a small group. There were probably 500, 700 people in the organization, which now numbers in the 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. But as happens in those societies, you stay around long enough and you move up. And the last year I was in the Society for Pediatric Research as an active member, which meant I was under 45, I was president of that society, which carried a lot of sort of reflected glory, but it was fun because you got a lot of national exposure. And it was just after I had come here to Michigan State. So I could, and I had a little department, I didn't have that much I had to do. So I was able to bounce around the country and be involved in a lot of things nationally. Because the person doing the same kind of work as secretary that I'd been doing for pediatric research, who was in the senior society, was not as active. So we did a lot with the senior society sort of as part of what we did for the junior society. And my wife was very involved with the society through the number of years I was secretary, until I became president of the Junior Society. So she worked to put the program together and to carry on the correspondence and do an awful lot of things, which is now done by an office of about six people. But That was very helpful to me because I got to know people all around the country and therefore knew who the young people were, and it helped in recruiting, and it helped get people on scientific programs, and I think generally it reflected well on the department and the group of us. Then, shortly thereafter, I became equally involved with the American Academy of Pediatrics, which has a group of committees, which are basically academic people, and I got involved with their committee programs and was active with them for 10 or 15 years. Then I also worked on a study section for the National Institute of Health, which was a training committee study section. And this had all kinds of payouts, one of which I met you, and you eventually came here. But anyway, I got to know John Useem from this university in sociology, and we became good friends, and that helped with a lot of our university relationships. Also, the activities at the NIH complemented the activities with the Pediatric Research Society and broadened my own involvement with people across the country. And it was the whole academic world of pediatrics at that time was not big. Mm-hmm. It was possible to know almost everybody who was anybody. Within a reasonable period of time. There's no way one could do that very easily today. But it was nice because you got to be on a first-name basis with most all the people that you were going to have to interact with or have the opportunity to interact with across the country.
It also meant you were away from campus quite a lot.
That's true. I was one of the original kind of visiting professors. I would occasionally visit home. And a lot of fun was made of that. At one point, I often thought of getting an apartment in Washington, D.C., because in addition to these other activities, I was a very eager young person to testify before Congress on things that had to do with kids. And so there were lots of opportunities to get down and Washington and testify on this committee or that committee. So that was fun. It was exciting. I met another group of people that way. But all of these things did keep me on the go. And my children reflect on it in their mature years that Dad was rarely around. And if anything happened, like one of the girls was hit in a hit-run accident while she was on her bike, I was out of town. When somebody fell off their horse and broke their arm, I was out of town. When somebody went off the diving board and hit the side of the pool, I was out of town. So these tales get retold frequently now in the later years. But yes, I was away a fair amount.
Cautionary tales for the grandchildren.
Yes.
I want to come back to the impact on the university, but you're talking about testifying. You got into trouble with the local medical society with your testimony.
Yes. Well, that's true. One of my, as I got more and more comfortable with testifying, I began to really sort of enjoy it, much as somebody who gets into theater and enjoys being on the stage. And I got asked to testify before Senator Kennedy when he was young and eager and getting a lot of publicity, and to testify on the quality of health care of children in this country. And in the course of it, I think he realized I could be used for political purposes. And this was a hearing that was covered by, for I'm not sure exactly why, by the television and press people. And I was asked a number of fairly provocative questions, and I made a couple of fairly provocative answers. I think it was Senator Kennedy that asked, can I be sure by going to my local pediatrician that my child will get good medical care? And I said, no, there's no way we have of effectively accrediting physicians once they graduate as to whether they're staying current with their medical affairs or not. This is still an issue I noticed in yesterday's paper. But I said, much about our system is pretty antiquated. It's not unlike running a Model T Ford in the Indianapolis 500 race. Well, those were the kind of statements that lovely little one-liners that the television could pick up. And I got back to Lansing to find that several of those quotes, without much substantiation, ended up in the local paper. And the local physicians were furious. They felt, I think I made some reference to, I come from a small town in the Midwest, and I know the quality of care cannot be relied on.
You said something about there's no guarantee the children in Lansing can get medical care.
Well, I'm not quite, I don't think that, well, anyway, whether it was something like that. Yeah. The point was it infuriated a number of local physicians, not particularly the pediatricians, but the internists and the surgeons were mostly offended. And they got so offended, they decided to have a hearing at Sparrow Hospital as to why I shouldn't be dismissed from the staff. And this hearing took place in August when the dean, Dr. Hunt, was on vacation. And the associate dean said, Dr. Hunt, you'd better come back. One of your chairmen is about to be kicked out of the local medical society and off the staff of one of the hospitals. So he came back and was very ticked off that he had to interrupt his vacation over this loudmouth young pediatrician. Anyway, I called Senator Kennedy and I said, yeah, I got a problem, and told him about it. And I said, I need 100 copies of the congressional testimony to distribute to show that the remarks I made, when taken in context, were not as awful as they were when they were.
Yes, they were.
Well, not really. Anyway, so the next day came this huge box of congressional records with all the testimony, which we then put on the stage in the amphitheater in the auditorium at Sparrow Hospital. And I said, you know, anybody that wants to read what was really said, please have a copy of this. Well, as it turned out, it all blew over, although there were a few physicians who never forgave me. And one who has subsequently left town never spoke to me again in the city. So, but anyway, yeah, it was an interesting time.
Yeah.
And I kind of, I think I was a little terrified. I was pleased by the fact that I got this kind of response.
What were our relationship with Sparrow Hospital?
Well, they were never very good. As a matter of fact, initially we did almost all our pediatrics at the Ingham Medical Center. There, the administration and the staff were much more tuned into the kind of values that we had for kids. It was a smaller program, considerably smaller in number of beds, but it had a nursing staff which was exceptional. an administration that was enormously supportive. On the other hand, Spiro Hospital, which was then separate from St. Lawrence was the third place. We did some work at St. Lawrence Hospital, but not a lot, although psychiatry was primarily at St. Lawrence. But Spiro had a lot of the people from the Department of Medicine, and it had almost all the practicing pediatricians had their patients at Spiro. And the general practitioners who admitted patients tend to do that at Ingham. So they would often use us as consultants, whereas Spiro, the private pediatricians, were their own consultants. So we were always a little on the outside at Spiro, which was considered the town's hospital. And we worked with them in that we put the first neonatal intensive care unit there and helped them develop that program, which is now big. So there were things we did together, but our emotional ties were mostly over at Ingham.
And how about the relationship with the pediatricians in the community?
Well, it wasn't bad. It wasn't great. We had some pediatricians in the community who were wonderful, supportive people. We had people in Saginaw and Grand Rapids and Flint who were wonderfully supportive people, pediatricians in those communities. There was Waterman in Grand Rapids and Heavenrich in Saginaw and Tauscher in Flint, who couldn't have been more supportive. And there were people in Lansing, like Comstock and Ellison, Trimby, and Sprig Jacob, who were very supportive. The kind of traditional pediatricians who had been here a while were more supportive than some of the new ones who came in who saw us as competition. So the older fellows who all had well-established practice and weren't threatened remained good friends and supportive and helped teach, whereas some of the younger people who came in were, I think, leery of the competition. They felt that we were being smug about some of the things we didn't say. And so our relationship with the newer pediatricians in town was always a little bit more tenuous than it was with the senior people.
Okay. Let's cycle back a little bit for a minute. You're running all over the country, testifying in front of Congress, and you have a department back home to run. How did you do that?
Well, that's a good question. Mostly two things. First, and I think important, was for during those years, we had a group of people who loved to work together. And there was very little friction. People found ways within themselves or within the group to make things happen. I think that was a big issue. The other was I had good people working with me who took over. You were one of those people. Art Corbin was another. Art loved to lead, and he welcomed the opportunity to sort of take over the job as chairman. He always felt he could do it better than I could, and probably did. Art is much more of a talk-to person. People felt more comfortable getting in conversations with Art about things that troubled them than they often did with me.
That's because he was not chair.
That's probably part of it. But I think he also has a personality that makes him seem more open. I'm not sure whether that's really what it is, but it was true. He was not chair, but he also had a very open and welcoming, welcoming type of listening mode. It was people such as yourself and Art, and eventually Ray Helfer, but that was mostly, I wasn't going away as much after Ray came, but he was another individual who could step in and equally serve as chair. So I was never lacking in people who felt comfortable doing that. But also we had a department which at that time hadn't created very many fusses between themselves. We had a group who tended to work it out within their own relationships more than needing some kind of strong administrative direction.
Okay. About 1973 or so, the department started a residency program. Why?
Well, that was easy. We had by that time recruited enough pediatricians who were interested in teaching pediatrics, advanced pediatrics, that is, the pediatrics of specialty care, pediatric hematology, pediatric cardiology, pediatric endocrinology, that was at a level above the kind of things that students needed to learn. And they wanted, the faculty wanted to be able to be challenged and to challenge young pediatricians coming into the field. And so one of the ways you do that in traditional medical schools is you have residents who are people after graduation from medical school go on and do specialty training in pediatrics, adult medicine, oncology, surgery, whatever. So we needed to have some people to train in pediatrics as a specialty. And at that time, I think it was at that time, Fred Matthews was on board. And he was going to organize the residency program, which was, interestingly, at Spiro.
Was it all three hospitals?
Was it all three?
Yeah.
I can't remember the details. Anyway, one of the first people that we were able to find, and I think this was sort of accidentally, was an osteopathic graduate. And he became our first resident who was being trained in pediatrics. And that was...
And Sparrow was really hesitant to give him...
an opportunity. Right, because he was a DO.
Yes.
I think that probably had a lot to do with how we happened to also be using Sparrow and, St. Lawrence and Ingham. But anyway, it grew quickly. It was, I think it was a good thing. Unfortunately, it further... invested the department in pediatric physicians rather than psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists, biologists, and so on. So the original concept of equal balance between behavioral, social, and biological science fell apart.
Right.
And it became almost entirely a clinical pediatric department. And it was about that time that I then retired as chair. And at the same moment that I left the chairmanship, the name was changed to pediatrics and human development, rather than just human development. I sort of regretted that, because it used to be fun to go to meetings and introduce yourself as chairman of a Department of Human Development, and nobody knew what you were talking about.
Yeah.
So you had a chance, or I had a chance, to talk about the college and the department and some of our thinking about medical education that, having had a standard name, would never have given me that opportunity. Hmm. But it was kind of fun.
Okay. What was behind the name change?
Probably a couple of things. One, it was becoming much more a traditional pediatric department, the way other pediatric departments existed in the country. We had a lot of pediatricians who were specialists, and we did mostly care of kids. So I think many of the faculty who hadn't been here at the beginning, but who'd come later, didn't have any particular tie to the concept of human development. Mm-hmm. And when they went around the country, they wanted to be known as pediatricians, mm-hmm. not human development specialists. So that was one part of it. And the other was that for accreditation purposes and for residency training purposes and residency recruitment, it was more understandable if we had pediatrics in the name. Mm-hmm. Luckily, they never dropped the human development, yes. which has been sort of a nice thing. I keep hoping that doesn't happen. So at least we have some vestige of our original goal and interest.
But at the same time that the medical school was developing, there was an osteopathic school of medicine on campus. How did our department relate to them?
Well, first of all, the osteopathic school came on campus at the same time that we got authorization to be a four-year medical school. So the osteopathic college was a private institution in Flint, and they were looking for a university home. Well, it was felt that Wayne State had all the problems they could deal with Detroit. They didn't need an osteopathic school. Mm-hmm. The University of Michigan felt it would be beneath them to have an osteopathic Correct. School. So Jack Breslin, who was at that time vice president here, could see what was happening. So he dealt with the legislature, as only Jack Breslin could do, and talked them into giving us a four-year accreditation if we at the same time would accept the osteopathic college as another medical school. Then we would have three: the College of Veterinary Medicine, the College of Osteopathic Medicine, and then the College of, it turned out, had to be Human Medicine. Otherwise, there was no way to distinguish it. And that's led to a lot of things. Anyway, eventually they set up their own departments, including a department of pediatrics, with which we never got very close. Interestingly, psychiatry became one department for both colleges. Okay. Surgery became one department for both colleges initially. OB became one department for both colleges initially. But adult medicine and pediatrics never did. And I don't really know fully why. Interestingly, the deans of both schools were pediatricians. Mm-hmm. And that may have had something to do with it, but I'm not quite sure how that would work out. Anyway, it didn't ever happen. So we never became closely associated with the osteopathic pediatric department. Now, interestingly, we're recruiting to the same residency program.
Yes.
So things do change.
Slowly.
Yeah, thank goodness.
How would you characterize the department under your chairmanship?
Well, it really was two phases. I could divide that period in half. In the first half, we were just a small nuclear family. Mm-hmm. We kind of lived together, talked together, played together, taught together. It was a kind of association which is rare but can happen.
Yeah.
And we had a great time together. And I think that ended as we began to recruit more and more people to the department who hadn't shared in that initial kind of exuberance. So in the second half of that period, we became increasingly a department with divisions. And although we had maybe only one person in pulmonary medicine, he wanted to be a division of pulmonary medicine. We had a division of hematology and oncology, nephrology, neonatology, and all these subspecialties began to see themselves as entities within the department. And as that began to grow, the cohesiveness of the whole group for each other was diminished. And they each faced somewhat different problems. So the hematology-oncology group faced a very different set of issues than the neonatology group. And they really didn't understand or appreciate the problems of the other group. So divisions developed. And it didn't get very far during that period, but it was the beginning of it. And that changed the whole course of where things were going. So I can't see that it could ever get back to that original period when we were all just one sort of happy family. It reminds me sort of the families that lived in communes.
Mm-hmm.
We were sort of a commune. And a lot of that kind of social interaction took place. It was lovely. But doomed to fail, doomed to end.
Yeah. Were the divisions partly the consequence of the need or the decisions about reimbursement for giving the patient care?
Probably. I think the original need for divisions was identity, individual identity. Mm-hmm. When you're applying for a grant, you need it look better to say chief of the division of hematology than just another faculty member in pediatrics. But it wasn't long before the way the reimbursement system was set up, which was one of the great mistakes the medical school made, was by groups by specialty.
Mm-hmm.
So the hematology-oncology group had their income from medical care. Neonatology, which has been the sort of the force that dragged everybody else along, had huge income. And partly because it was started out that neonatal intensive care would be paid for by some system or another. When we started the Department of Public Health, which was what it was called, now the Department of Community Health, paid for all of neonatal care. not for long, but for the beginning to get it started, and it start, and that sort of went through the whole state. They set up the regional neonatal care system, and to get it going and supporting it, they paid most of it. There was a heyday of a period for neonatal medicine in that period. So they've been the, for one reason or another, which is a complicated story, they've been the funding chunk of the department's medical care dollars. But everybody got jealous about their own dollars and defensive about the money they didn't make. And it led to further splintering and further lack of cohesiveness within the department. It's, I think, it'll be almost impossible to get it back on an even keel. It could be done. Others have done it, but it's not easy. I see that as sort of the saddest chapter of the whole development.
But perhaps inevitable.
Oh, I'm sure probably inevitable. Well, I'm not sure. It seems inevitable. There were ways around it, but it would have taken some great foresight to have avoided this sort of straightforward pitfall to which they fell.
Several directions in which I want to go. Talk about a little bit about some of the people you brought in early.
About the people that came?
Yeah.
Because they really, I didn't bring in very many myself. I obviously got through me, but individual faculty did a lot of the recruiting. In the early years, we didn't need to have positions posted. We didn't have job descriptions. We just found somebody we liked or thought we could use and got them to come and visit, and we recruited them and hired them. We didn't go through lists of candidates or anything. It was very much a one-on-one basis. So when I went to Seattle and found Tom Helmreth finishing his fellowship in neonatology, I asked if he wanted to come to East Lansing, and he came out and looked and said, yeah. So that, but that was one of the few people I personally recruited. Most of the others were recruited by other members of the faculty. Well, I know so-and-so. Or what about this guy I met? And they would go out and bring them on board. So at the beginning, it was very much an individual effort of various faculty members. It also resulted in the fact that everybody that came was pretty much of one ilk. Very liberal politically, educationally oriented, not overly concerned about financial remuneration, and not troubled terribly by rules, regulations, and so on. That was for a period of time. And then came sort of the standard way one had to do recruiting. You had to put an ad somewhere, and you had to take candidates, and you had to interview all kinds of people. That has paid dividends that are less clear. A number of those people that came really didn't fit. They looked like it, and partly I think we were anxious to get somebody to fill a position, and the person was anxious to find a job, so they were put into this place, but it really wasn't what they wanted. either the money wasn't sufficient or the independence wasn't sufficient. So there are probably a half a dozen people in the community here who are practicing, who were once faculty members, who've gone out and left the university to become individual entrepreneurs. To me, that was kind of a failure. But it was after my involvement was passed. But I think it had begun before I got done. It started just before I was finished as being chair, that we were beginning to get into this less personal, more...
Bureaucratic.
Yeah. That's a good word. Method of hiring and appointing people. I think it has not done well overall.
Yeah.
I have no idea whether that's unique to our situation or whether that's a fairly common finding across the country. I have no idea. I'm not involved enough in the country nationally to have any idea whether that was a common problem elsewhere or not.
I think some of the problem was a reflection of greater problems in the medical school.
Well, that could be. I think what we were going through was being part of what the medical school was going through.
Yeah.
The whole business of what to do with clinical income was being disruptive throughout the college. And it was always a problem because the College of Osteopathic Medicine seemed to have more income in that field than College of Human Medicine, and that created some difficulty. But those are really beyond things that we can talk authoritatively about.
You were involved in the planning of the Clinical Sciences Center.
Right. Well, that was a wonderful experience. Actually, the building planning that went on during those first 10 years was an exciting element of the whole business. First, when I was being recruited here, and before I actually arrived, the planning of the life sciences building was going on. So I got to get involved with that planning actually before I set foot on the campus. And I remember Dr. Swisher and I'm trying to think of the people on the college university who came to Gainesville, Florida, where I was living, with plans, and we sat around in Gainesville looking at plans for life sciences and figuring out what should be where and how this should be done. And it got me very involved with the whole college before I actually was on the campus, which was wonderful because that remained a great entree. Then the next building, there was a little temporary building we tried to do, which was going to be a little better. We were housed as a department initially in the Olin Health Center.
Yep.
And we were on the third floor on one end and medicine, Department of Medicine on the other end. And we decided we needed a little medical center over there. And the Olin Health Center was no longer allowed to become an inpatient facility for fire and safety reasons. So we designed a wonderful little building built with a couple of hairpin-type structures and a beam across the top where they would be prefabricated rooms brought to the site and hauled up on this beam, and then they would be attached after they got up there so that one room would attach to the next to the utilities. It was wonderful design. Then, for reasons I'm not entirely clear, it got dropped. But about that time, then we began to plan the clinical center, and we had a wonderful time. We saw this as being the beginning of a major clinical medicine campus with eventually a VA hospital and the Olin Health Center being moved over to where the clinical center was. And there were things like a elevated railroad that would run from the clinical center to the Fee Hall, to biochemistry, and so on. And that would have little individual cars, like tiny railroad, and you'd get on a car, like an elevator car, except it would be horizontal. You'd push a button, number two for Fee Hall, and this thing would go around this track and drop you at Fee Hall, and then be available for the next person who needed it. And there'd be several of these cars moving around. It went so far as to have a little station at the clinical center that still sticks out from the front of the clinical center. That was going to be the second floor landing spot. And that was built so that could be done. But after the design got done and the building got under construction, the funds for that part of it went away. So the elevated railroad disappeared, but the little projection on the front of the clinical center is still there. To remind people, which nobody would know except a few of us, was part of a very different plan. But we planned with great fun, and it was originally designed so that a hospital could be built on the east side of it. So all the facilities that hospitals would share with the clinic, like the laboratory and the radiology department and the medical record department, are all on the east side of that building, so that when the hospital got built next to it, the hospital radiology department would just be abutted to the outpatient department. So all that got done with that in mind. There were also wonderful little things like care was going to be given within each clinical unit so that the pharmacy, if you had a prescription for the pharmacy, it went in a little tube up to a train that ran around between the floors.
Oh, wow.
And the train would take the prescription to pharmacy, which was going to be in the back of the building where it wouldn't interfere with anything. Then the medicine would go back up into the train, which would deliver it to the clinical module. And there would be a clinical pharmacist in each module who would then dispense it to the patients. So the patient never had to leave the module. And if they had to have blood drawn, the blood was drawn in the module, then set up in this little train and sent to the laboratory. So the patient never had to go there. Anyway, all kinds of wonderful things and wonderful communication systems. It was even going to have electronic medical records, and that's like 20 years ago. It was a very remarkable building. Unfortunately, after it was underway, the funds got cut. And so all the nice little things like the railroad and the pneumatic systems and the communication systems were cut from it. And we got left with a building which was fascinating, but nobody understands because all the stuff that made it operate was left out.
I see.
So it's been looked on as kind of an eyesore, but it was fun.
And had a child care center.
Yes, it had a child care center. And that actually functioned for a while. Got lost in the financial problems of how could we afford to do this? We don't have any income for it. I think it would have been and still would have been a good idea had it kept mm-hmm. going, but there were many things got lost.
That's right. Okay. Let's see, you left the chairmanship in...
79.
Okay. Why did you decide to step down as chair?
Oh, I was tired. Furthermore, I had a preconceived idea that 10 years was as long as anybody should be chair. Mm-hmm. And I got that impression from looking at what was going on around the country. People who stayed more than 10 years were either in trouble or things were just stagnating. Mm-hmm. And it came clear to me that 10 years was plenty long for anybody to be chairman. So when I took the position originally, I said, 10 years. And I kept that in mind mm-hmm. through the whole time, sort of looking at that 1978 date as a kind of an opening yeah. to another world. Well, as it turned out, for a variety of reasons, had to do with other parts of the medical school, it wasn't convenient for me to leave that hold till mm-hmm. the next year. So I stayed till 79, which was not a particularly productive year. But the fact was, so much had changed since I'd come on board that I was no longer really in tune with what was going on in the college or even in the department. It had all outgrown my fanciful concepts of what it should all be mm-hmm. about. And the realities of modern commercial medicine were making itself so apparent it wasn't much fun.
Yep.
And the sense of accomplishment and wonder that one had initially kind of got lost. So it seemed, indeed, the department needed a different kind of person. Mm-hmm. And they've been struggling with that for a long time, trying to figure out what that kind of person was. But it clearly wasn't myself.
Okay. As I recall, it had a... Was Ray temporary chair?
Yes.
Okay.
And he was going to be chair when he died. He died in Spain suddenly, and he was going to be coming back and be chair. But that...
Was that before or after Marshall Klaus was chair?
I'd have to go... I don't recall.
I thought Ray was temporary chair while they recruited Marshall.
Yeah.
And then Marshall left and Mike Nesloff.
Yeah, see,
chair.
I think it was before Mike came on. Ray was going to be chair after Marshall left.
Okay.
I think. And then because he died.
I thought Ray was going to be chair after Nesloff and before
Well,
Iceberg.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I'd have to go back
yeah.
and reconstruct it. I should, but I don't know.
I don't know if there are any records that will tell us.
Oh, yeah. No, I think we could put it together by when he died
yep.
and who was
okay.
where when.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that should be reconstructed.
Okay. At one point, you and Scott Swisher put together a primary care grant.
Yeah. That's true, we did. We decided that this was very early, at the very beginning.
Yep.
We decided that if we were going to teach students about medical care, being that primarily you were a doctor and secondarily you were a pediatrician mm-hmm. or an internist, you ought to be able to do both. And so we set up a small clinic where we would see children and adults. And on the days there were mostly kids, Dr. Swisher would supervise, and when there were adults, I would mostly supervise. And the students and residents would, we already had a few residents at this point, would work across the age group. And if they were, I was seeing them and they were seeing an adult, then I would supervise them. Well, Scott Swisher and I loved it. We really felt we could do this sort of thing effectively. The residents never felt totally comfortable with it. Even though they weren't very far along in their training, they had already begun to think children versus adults.
Yeah.
And so once Scott and I got too busy to do this on a regular basis, we were never able to get faculty in our departments to pick up the pieces. Hmm. So it died.
Okay. There were also some cum-trumps with the town physicians in the residency when you got the grant.
I don't remember.
Like you and Scott wrote it over a weekend and submitted it without telling anybody?
Oh, well, that's true. But that's the way we tended to function. It wasn't a lot of money anyway, but it just seemed like a good idea. Mm-hmm. We sat down and put it in. It obviously struck somebody correctly. It was an interesting idea that really, I think was right, but to find people to run it was not easy.
Yeah.
There weren't many with the same concept.
Okay. I think one of the things that, for me, always characterized the early department was the appointment of the Schnorrer professor.
Well, yeah. David Klein was a professor on campus and interested in accidents, accident prevention, and the multitude of factors that led to accidents. And Art Corman met David and ultimately got David to come and teach some of this, part of pediatrics, part of child development, human development. And so when it turned out that his home department was willing to share him with us without our putting up any money, we felt the least we could do was to give him some kind of title. And in trying to figure out how we could give him a rank without having any money attached to it and any specific time commitment, there's an old Yiddish word for a kind of beggar called a schnorrer. Somebody who snores is somebody who gets things for nothing by... So we decided, well, we'll call him the Schnorrer Professor. Who will know? So we put through an appointment letter form to the university naming David Klein Schnorrer Professor of Human Development. Well, we didn't hear anything for a while, and we got a call from Jack Breslin, who was then vice president, but also secretary to the board of trustees. And certain kinds of named professorships have to go to the board for approval. So I get this call from the vice president. Who was Mr. Schnorrer who gave this money to fund Professor Klein's appointment? And I got kind of hysterical, and I said, Jack, this is a joke. He said, what do you mean it's a joke? So I explained the origin of the word and how it came about, and he said, well, it's not very funny because it's on the Board of Trustees agenda, and there's no way to get it off. And I said, well, you know, I'm sorry about that, but it just seemed like such a good thing. Yeah. So it got taken off the board agenda. Just, I'm not sure how they explained it, but it never went through. But we were teased a fair amount by the university administration for a while. They really didn't think it was very funny, but we thought it was great.
Yes.
But anyway.
We had a warmer and friendlier relationship with administration in those days.
Yes, we did. And I think because, first of all, Dr. Hunt was friends with most everybody in the administration. He had been recruited in John Hanna's heyday, and everybody in the at that time, the university administration was a little like our department in the early years. There was a sense of togetherness within the administration when the university was growing to be its mega university from a very small place. And I think John Hanna imbued that with a sense of fellowship and integrity that's hard to do. It takes special periods of growth. I think that's how we were fortunate to be able to do it. And I think during his period of rapid growth of the university, he was able to do it and get away with it. So that, when Andy came, that same university administrative spirit involved Andy. And he was friends with most of the administration people. And that made it easy for the rest of us to interact with them as well. So our relations with the university administration were good. And we got a number of things done which would have been difficult to do otherwise.
Okay. How would you characterize the department when Marshall Klaus was chair?
I don't know. I haven't really felt I could characterize the department after I stopped being chair. It was at the beginning. There was so much of a tendency for people to keep coming to me and saying, I don't like this, what would you do? So I needed to back out of as much of the departmental activities as a department as possible to keep from really making it worse for the existing chair. And I think it was a difficult time for me to stay here. Had I been wiser and other people been wiser, I might well have left at that point, physically left, but didn't. I was comfortable here. I had a lot of things going for me here.
You took a sabbatical, didn't you?
I took a sabbatical,
yeah.
But it wasn't enough. It wasn't long enough to really divorce me from the department. So I sort of stayed out as much as possible of department affairs. And I can't honestly say I can characterize any one of the chairs or what the department was like or different one way or another from when another person was chair. There were problems for everybody. I think that was inevitable in some ways. It's interesting. The time I was acting chair in Florida, I sensed a little of that taking over somebody else's department. On the other hand, I'd been there 4 years before I became chair, so I knew the department well, and that made it easier. Also made it stranger because taking over as chair after having been a faculty member for 4 years and then becoming chair, you suddenly no longer had the friends you once had. And for the people who went from being a faculty member here to being a chair, they eventually saw how much that changed their personal relationships with others. I had seen that. But I think when you come in from the outside, brand new as a chair, to a department that's been functioning as a group, it's very hard to become the leader in less than probably 5 years. Mm-hmm. And nobody much lasted much more than 5 years.
That's right.
I just think it was unfortunate. And I think the other problem was that we had created a kind of special place in the first 5 years that we were here. The second 5 years, although they weren't as much fun or as exciting, they perpetuated that myth that we had a special kind of a place. And even though people who came later were not aware of what that was, there was this sense that there had been something which was close to nirvana.
Right.
And it was up to whoever came in to recreate that nirvana. Mm-hmm. And I think it was not possible. I don't think, you know. And I think the sad part is that many of the people who came in to chair the department were saddled with that responsibility, which they couldn't, which no one could have met. So I don't know specifically how one situation was better or worse than another.
Okay.
The interesting thing I must say about the Klaus situation was that when he been a medical student, I was the pediatrician for his children.
Really? I didn't know that.
And so we go back to that same situation I had with Art Corbin, except now suddenly Marshall came in was chair and I was a faculty member, where he'd been a student when I was a faculty member at Case Western. It was an interesting kind of a juxtaposition.
It's hard to follow a charismatic leader.
Well, I think it's hard to follow a period which was so unique.
Yeah.
Which was unique. And no matter what had happened subsequently, you couldn't do that again, no matter who you were. And I think that's what was the problem. I don't think it was the quality of leadership so much. I don't think I had that much greater ability or lesser ability than anybody else. I think I had the opportune time in an opportune situation, in an opportune place, to create something that was fun, exciting, different, and caught people's imagination. Mm-hmm. And that was as much the circumstances of the time and place as it was anything else.
I can go on for hours. You want to do it another time? But this seems like it might be a good stopping point because it's sort of the end of your chairmanship.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Very good.
Good.
All right.